Both of those who have not yet put down Malapan feet. What is it you're talking about?
Very powerful here. The fight about our own. Be personal, tactically related to that, or the more personal, or intentional, personal superintendent advertising. And it sounds like some of the things we're doing referring to and stuff that personal, would be incorporated in, or at least.
And what I enable to do as a person is to take responsibility for myself and it will lay down. Yes, sir. I start out thinking that there's a lie and very pretending as if I expected them to act were going to behave with me. This technological threat to your well-being here has kept you in the same style. Now you've got really heavy duty mistakes. Professing the strength. Now give me an example, if you will, of a heavy duty mistake in your sense, to which I can address myself.
Well, the example that you think is going to address your whole credit to me, that's an awesome thing, Bobby.
And you want to know how I know that that's a mistake?
I don't know anybody would. I mean, here's the new frame of reference.
The first thing that would have to happen is that they would have to indwell my frame of reference to the J-Line. And when they did, then they would see, by golly, Bochita's right, we made a mistake. If they didn't, then there's damn little that I could say, especially of the knockdown sort, that would disclose to the person in question, Jack, indeed, he has made a mistake, and he's one of the sore cancer of my disease. But then, you see, we don't generally settle anything of any importance this way. We do it on a piecemeal basis. And you and I are right now embarked upon a piecemeal effort to get at the question about what a mistake is of this large-scale sort. And what starts to happen is I say something and you respond to that, and then I say something back, and either this goes on for eternity, a thought that is bubbling in the leaf, alternatively, you begin to see that what I'm talking about presents an alternative perspective on things, or the other way around, I begin to say, well, people are wrong. And you should withdraw from publication further sale of the book that you are being paid so lavishly to them.
Metaphysics of persuasion.
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to follow up on John's question, though I think you may have just answered me. You suggested that you working in Ken, Blondie's, makes you a little uncomfortable. You think it's kind of backsliders. I appreciate what I take to be your emphasis on mind bodiliness. There's a certain sense in which we already ought to remember that. And you kind of come back to that, went to his bedrock. It does seem to me one thing in Polanyi that I think is very interesting is the kind of dynamism there. There is in Polanyi this tremendous emphasis on breaking out.
Right.
And so there's a certain sense in which the world is dynamic and the person that we are is always developing and changing. And our mind, body, in a certain sense, is in itself growing. And it seems to me that it's partly because of that sort of direction toward the future that Polanyi is fairly interested in things like universal intent. I wonder what you'd respond to that one.
Well, my response is that you're absolutely right in everything you have to say about the dynamism of Polanyi's thought. There's no question whatsoever about it. And if I have picked up a single example about the from, the dangers, the pitfalls that are resident in the from to evil, is for the limited purposes that I use it for, and nothing more. And I want to be sure that you understand what I mean and what I don't mean when I say what I said about universal intent. Polanyi felt obliged. This is the way I imagine it. What was going on with Polanyi when he wrote this out is, of course, was not even known to Polanyi. But in saying that I assert that she was universal intent, seemed to be what would be for me a gratuitous assertion of the reality of the world between which and myself nothing can be intruded. And in saying that universal intent takes care of the threats of that possibility, namely that something can be intruded, he is to such an extent paying dues to a foundation which I would avoid to begin with. It might be of some interest for you to know that I don't understand these books that I have written. And what I mean by that is that in order to write them, I had to enter into a different mode of being. When I did, it was easy. Because all I did was to report on what it was like in this mode. But of course, I very quickly got out of that mode, not by re-entering, as it were, the common sense world of getting my oil changed and picking up the dogs at the vets and that sort of thing. But I re-entered the world in which coherence versus correspondence and all of those things become problems. And I had to, in order to do the next day's work, I had to, as it were, undergo a kind of asthesis, to give in, to surrender, to a reality. The reality of the thisness of my mind body, to which I have an unmediated relationship, more powerful than any I can have to the various mediated ways in which that mind-body appears in its whatness. I am, after all, a father, an organism, a sinner, sometimes a penitent. Freud would be able to interpret why I'm coughing at this point. A member of the AAR, which I'm not. In other words, all of these predicates that could be used about my whatness from time to time and the appearance that I have as that whatness do not command me with anything like the importunity that the unmediated business of my mind-body does. And so in order to put these things down in writing, I have to submit to the discipline of this mode. Rock.
We used to always say we were in grad school that if we were to take up the position that you articulate and that we talked about in our seminars, the world would look different but would stay absolutely the same. And I'm wondering, and I mean this as a serious question, if we look at all of the categories that we use as intellectuals that are all products of the Enlightenment, religion is a category, politics is a category, social life is a category, mythology is a category. And then we decide to say, well, let's rework all these. Let's think through them. But nothing changes, although they look different. And I ask you seriously, is it worth it to do that? Is it worth it to rethink through those? When we live them through with integrity.
Only if you're going to get a PhD and teach in an academic institution. I know that you want a different answer from that. One, a different in the sense of a different kind of answer.
No, I don't.
But no, I don't. I often find myself wondering, well, what difference has all this made to you? And I guess the answer is, it has served to deepen my depression. And the reason for that is that the signs of the bondage that we suffer at the hands of the tradition that you just outlined in terms of categories is ubiquitous every way you look in this culture, and it's those trivial activities.
Apollonia, of course, would say this is not something that we really relax ourselves into. This is the disease of modern life, and the things we value will disappear if we let those, the kind of enlightenment, clarity, destroy them. So he's committed to overcoming. Jerry? Oh, you want to take a break?
I'll take a break.
Okay, then we'll start out with Jerry's question when we come back. We'll take a 5 minute
tea break.
All right. With Jerry's question. So if we'll take our seats, we'll let Jerry stand and we'll get started again. The floor is yours.
One thing that I noticed going on here in these two sessions that I would like to hear more about, there's been a kind of contrast between all the traditional talks about the world out there and up here, how to get across that gap. So what we're doing in the vertical revolution, we are suggesting that mind body concept, we're already in the world, we don't have to cross that gap. And it still seems to me a little bit individualistic to contrast that to me, my mind, and body concept. Occasionally, in terms of dialogue or something, but it looks kind of like the world. The axis of in here, one concrete way to put this is the principle that we were talking about in Richard King, that I guess I've always been guilty of giving that term or critiquing it interpretation as opposed to a corresponding old interpretation. How to put that to me, and use it on the to talk about us as we are universally intended. We're trying to talk to here and kind of get an agreement to conjure up our world and our comfortable way to live. And it's that kind of lateral mind and body. Got out of the case of this when you said the world is clean. I'd like to hear more about that.
Well, this is a criticism that I have received before, and in the light of the criticism, this was made early on in a manuscript or part manuscript version of Polanyian Meditation by someone known to many of you, namely Tom Langford, who said pretty much exactly what you just said about what he regarded as the deficiencies of my argument. And I took that to heart. Langford is also the author of the most illuminating and chastening evaluation of my work that I have ever heard, and I cherish him for this and other reasons. He said, Poteet accepts too much. And I know that this is true. But let me just say that your alarm is well-founded in the sense that it ought not to... Nothing I say ought to suggest what you have felt that it does suggest. And over again, to the point where I have felt that it becomes excessively wordy, I've always tried to ally references to my mind-body to our jointly or our convivial mind-bodies in the world. In other words, saying that the world is not something between me and my and something else, but it's something that is shared and by and participated in by all of us at the same time. But the reason that you get this impression is because of a tactical
move that I made. And that is, I found that this Copernican revolution that I found emerging in my own transactions will be unmediated business of my mind, body, and the world was always, as I tried to articulate it and get hold of it, in the first person. And so I found that if I didn't talk about it initially in the first person, it would get away from me. In other words, I was drawn away from the actual source of my inspiration by the attempt to give it universal intent. So I think, Jerry, if you will look at particularly the Philosophical Daybook and perhaps even more in the book that is yet to appear, you will see that I have been, on the one hand, more confident that I could hold on to the original inspiration so that I could speak more openly and more often about this being our convivially shared world. I could not agree more with the pitfalls of thinking of these first personal terms exclusively. So it's a practical rhetorical device rather than a philosophical one that's at issue here.
Thank
you. Well,
yeah, back over here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the question, McGee, you're pointing to me, Charlie?
Yes.
Okay. I love the light shifting just a little bit, but I don't think it's shifting very far. And the question I had, good for what John raised earlier, he's in a situation in a school where it is... where only intentional obstacles can ignore the issues related to diversity and multiculturalism. And you said earlier that, you know, you've not been interested in issues of politics and ethics in regards to your studies, quantity, and your work with me. But it seems to me that what you've talked about is the very center of the entire nexus of issues that we roughly refer to as multiculturalism or diversity.
Yes.
And it seems to me, furthermore, that there are direct and immediate political implications, not for political structures as such, but for us in the way we teach.
Oh, yes.
And that in my own case, I'm having trouble communicating to colleagues and others that the issues of how we teach relate to whether we can create an ambiance in the classroom that is different from this kind of constructed world that we've been talking about in some of the questions we've been dealing with this morning.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm interested in is what steps we can take to alter power equations in such a way as to create the kind of awareness that the world is the way you're describing it. That is, that gives a sense of we-ness and not just mine. Because when the students bring the other kind of world to the classroom, if you don't do something to change that world through the changing of the power equations of one another, that being able to communicate in the way you're talking about and opening them up to those kinds of possibilities just virtually wasted time.
Well, I could not agree more with what you just said. And if I have not commented in writing upon the whole nest of questions that arise with multiculturalism and political correctness and fascist police that are taking over our faculties is simply because I found that what I have done is it demands so much of my time and energy that I can't go the next step and do what you're proposing needs being done, and which I agree needs being done. All I can do is to keep up with what's going on university and college campuses in this country and take more doses of Maalox as a result of learning what's going on. Now, thank God, at least it seems up to this point, the teacher is still sovereign in his classroom. It may happen day after tomorrow that that's no longer so. But as long as you are sovereign in your classroom, you have the opportunity of dealing with the student on a face-to-face basis on these very questions. I made the discovery in the mid-60s. I had some grand schemes about how we could reform graduate education in order that liberal arts colleges could be made better than they in general were. And I proposed at a meeting called by Victor Butterfield, who at that time was president of the American Association of Colleges, convened for the purpose of discussing this question, that something needed to be done in order to help liberal arts colleges. And when we had spent 2 or 3 days on this, I finally said, well, isn't what's wrong with the liberal arts college what's wrong with the graduate schools? And everybody said, yeah, that's right. And I said, well, isn't that where we ought to do our work? And they said, yeah. Where would you begin? And I said, well, I suggest it as a modest beginning that we have a convocation that meets at Duke on one day and Carolina on the next day, and that we take 20 faculty from each of these two institutions whom we deem to be, on the face of it, sympathetic to a discussion of this sort of thing and in positions of sufficient power in the institutions for their opinions to matter. And I said, I have a requisition paper that takes apart the creature of the Enlightenment, which is the creature of the Enlightenment at its worst, which is the German university that had been imported to these shores. Well, I was lucky to survive these two meetings on successive days. I mean, the hostility that is directed to me for having written this paper was quite literally frightening. So I decided it's pointless to take on the graduate school prevalent. So now on, I'm going to use all of the energy that I have with trying to corrupt the minds of graduate students. And as some of you will have noticed by some of the comments that have been made in here, I was not an entire failure in this. Indeed, the poet Elizabeth Thurl paid me the rather equivocal compliment of saying that Poteet has educated a whole generation of misfits. Now, that's what you are in your place, in your classroom. And the thought police may come knocking on your classroom door and usher you out and take you to a place that you dare not even think about. But until that time, you have got 50 minutes or whatever it is with this group of students in order to meet them face to face on these questions. And it will not be a pretty sight. But what else is there to do? Okay?
I did to ask a question that I think ties together several question too, and that has to do with essentially the ethical import of focusing on our mind, body, being. I know you don't address that directly, but from your perspective, does a recovery of our rootedness in the world have ethical import? And if so, in what direction?
Well, it certainly has ethical import. First and foremost, insofar as it places us where we ought to be. And that is the conditio sine qua non of thinking about ethics and what is right and what is good. That's very different from doing what is right and what is good. But we know we have far greater clarity, I would argue, on the basis upon which we would defend what we say about the right and the good, if we are located at the place that I'm suggesting we all in fact are. You know, I'm not telling you anything that you don't already live your life on. I'm simply telling you something that you're not accustomed to talking about. Now, is that responsive to your interest,
yes,
Jeffrey?
Well, yes, it is. As you know, in Heidegger's,
yes,
and in your work, is that there is an ethical involved to this. And it's related to any notion like of alienation that the Cartesian world and the games we can play in them lead us into.
Preeminently, my ethical category is responsibility, and preeminently my preeminent category in philosophical anthropology is my taking responsibility. Well, me to take responsibility is for me to be. Dale? Well, I'm preempting the...
I was going to people who hadn't spoken before.
Yeah, by all means, and Dale has spoken far too much.
Not much this morning, but let's go to Jim and then Dale.
Yes.
After all your comments, well, my way... Yeah, surgeon's scalpel to cut himself tomorrow. A couple observations. Polanyi, my historical situation is the stage upon which I receive my calling. Kierkegaard's Abraham, who hears the word, take his son to Mount Moriah. Kierkegaard seems to me to be suggesting at that moment his world is exploding. That in a sense, he's under pressure. Had it taken away. Comment on that,
apropos. No, I'm saying, yeah. What I've been saying has nothing to do with that case. What I've been saying is about something else.
Well, I think it is too, but I think this other needs to be said, because otherwise you sound like Jean-Paul Sartre lording it over being.
Oh, my God.
This is a
viper that I have nurtured in my own house.
Obviously, I'm going back and I assume that you do. I mean, you've quoted time to time Augustine talking about that one who is closer to us than we are to ourselves, even when we're very far from thee. Kierkegaard talking about the concrete self-relation. Being convivial, if you will,
yes,
in a relation to another. And it seems to me that when we talk about shifting dwelling places, it's at the edge of the world. It's neither in the world nor out of the world. It's transcendent, not without immanence somehow, but that's part of what's bugging the conversation.
Well, would you subscribe to the proposition that you can explode from one world into another world?
Well, I'm not sure that in a search sense that's not exactly what happens in the pathos of Abraham's encounter on Mount
I would go farther than that and give you permission to say that's exactly what's happening.
Yeah. Okay, but then it's not happening in some sort of vacuum. The dialectic here in Kierkegaard's terms would be a pathetic dialectic, not a right.
Well, exactly so, but none of our shifts from one world into another, whether they are trivial or of a magnitude such as infanticide, is different in its logical structure. That is to say, the shift from one world, this sentence has got to be completed. The shift from one world,
the people in that
world are going to be very puzzled by this.
They will anyway.
I think you understand how that's here.
The shift from... Let me put it this way, Jim, in a very commonsensical way. I dare say, I certainly hope, that as a result of my being here last night and my being here this morning, some of the people in the room have had their worlds exploded and find themselves, if not in a world, at least in a must. And I want to say that that's happening to us all individually in our, as we now say, our relationships and in our intellectual endeavors and in our efforts to bring an intellectual argument to some kind of intelligibility and so on.
But would you say also that in Polanyian terms, Abraham Case or others too, would be a dwelling in, which is not only mind-body, but also cultural and traditional.
Yes.
And that's precondition of breaking out. That it is not merely that the breaking out is incidental to it.
Based on which I receive my call.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Dale?
My question is directed differently. It sounds like the direction of the question. I think it provides a ground for the question. Polanyi, a great deal of personal knowledge is concerned with what Polanyi called the intellectual and moral as characterized the project in the test of the nature of achieving a balanced mind with spiritual solidity and moral pleasure. And that whole dimension of if you will, finding balance without enerving moral passion or losing it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just moral passion.
Intellectual
fashion. Yeah. A heuristic fashion.
Yeah. I don't find you attending very much explicitly in what in your later work. You are attending more to sort of ground level things in our the body side of the equation. Don't spend a whole lot of time talking about passion.
I thought that I was spending a lot of time exhibiting it.
Yes, I think that's right. What I'm asking you, and it's an open-ended question,
yeah.
Not what you've done, but how, do you want to say any more about how you would see how the passion related to the land? Particularly like it in connection with the whole notion of poetry.
The whole notion of what? Yes. I would take it for granted that everything that appears in our personal life is grounded in this unmediated business that is our individual and convivial mind, bodies, and the world. And I see the same, in principle, the same passion at work in the balletic movements of a neonate in concert with its mother's voice and mother's movements. And
the articulations by Johann Sebastian Bach of, let us say, the musical offer, which is perhaps one of the most complex pieces of music, certainly of contrapuntal music, ever written. The same thing is going on in both cases, and it's ubiquitous. And you can call it an intellectual passion, you can call it a heuristic passion, and whether you will call it the one or the other will depend on what it is you're trying to say about the good. But you're right, I haven't said anything in anything I've written that sounds like what I just said. In a way, I guess I take this all quite for granted. Find that indeed in trying to put this stuff down, I'm being borne along by these things.
So you're also articulating the locus of the passion too. So
yes.
It doesn't seem that it's a distinction that will come up with the mind body itself.
Very good, Robert. It's good to hear you after all these years. It's still crazy. Wally.
It seems to me that a major thrust of your thought is not only to examine your mind body, or expand this to incorporate much in pretensive dialectic of the world, but also to go back to the phrase you used at the cartesian center, or to be pressed back towards that, we get more and more to, again using your terminology, undifferentiated background of the ground that itself is impersonal. I use the concomitant on that view, not just for the black hole, because you use the word infinite density. When we get into those kind of concepts, no differentiation, it seems to me the boundaries of the mind-body are established by differentiation. Intentionality comes from it.
Oh, yeah.
I'm seeing the trial because Jim had this problem with my manuscript. Say, well, we get to a dimensional kind of origin. I'm puzzled by what this leads to in my own thinking. Can you say something about that? Can you go back?
Now, just pinpoint what puzzle it is you want me to speak to.
I guess it is, how does intentionality arise from a lack of intentionality? How does the ground emerge from the background? So things are distinctly different, impersonal.
I find myself, as I listen to you, Wally, translating what you're asking into the way that I apprehend that most dense of all entities in the universe, namely myself. And I don't think about it in the categories that you have used to pose your question. I, in a sense, don't think about it. What I do is I try to surrender to the claim upon me of this increasingly elusive reality, which is itself intentional, and which I experience as intentional. I don't impute that to it until after the fact, until I begin to think about it and talk about it. But I just find myself walking around in the world, projected out of this as yet unarticulated intentionality. And in one sense, I could say, In answer to the question, well, how did you know that?
Well, Pete, if you don't talk about it, and the answer is, well, I just notice
what I do, what I'm doing,
how what I'm doing requires that.
But you would not think it's fair to say, wouldn't you? I thought of what I read in the audience. He was saying that you wanted to say, but it sounded like, without equivocation, that the self has, the self has neither spatial nor temporal extension. I can see you saying that in a certain mode, but that is to say, not without qualification. In other words, are you saying that the self has neither spatial nor temporal
extension?
It depends on the context within which I'm talking about it. And the context in which I
would be talking about it
would define the sense of space and the sense of time that had a bearing on that sense of the self that I was trying to articulate and communicate to you and to myself. Those sentences he read from Polanyi on 191 and 192, of course, would be very vulgar. Here you only talk about space and extension, the light of something that's already there.
But I said without qualification.
Yeah.
And then up front, I'm going to turn you into a Gnostic. You say that this is great.
I know that, Jim, that you are out like that old figure on the Dutch cleanser bottle, chasing Bert, but in your case, that is
just trying to figure if you said without qualification what I
thought. I never say anything without qualification. Let's see, we got Walter and Jerry. I saw Jerry's hand first and then Walter.
Well, both spoken before.
I think you're absolutely excited. I recall you're telling us 80 years ago it's impossible to believe about McNeil. When you moved to a new neighborhood,
McNeil is my son.
He was three. That wandered next door. The neighbor was digging in his garden. He looked up and said, "Oh, just begin there. They're nice looking little boy. What is your name?" "My name is Neil." And he said, "Well, do you have any brothers?" And he said, "No." "No, I don't have got two sisters." "They've got a brother, and that's me." "There's a whole geez, you know, I mean, it's so I've used that for over 30 years. It relates to this bit about self and how one comes to be aware of your self identity through the relationship to find yourself.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I do subscribe to it. And yeah, you know, reminds me of it periodically, even though he's now in his 40s. You got old while you and I got old there. But I'll tell my other kid story, which is full of philosophical import. Also, my two daughters, who were 20 months apart, both had measles at the same time. I came home, and they were supposed to stay in bed and be still and not cause trouble and get themselves excited, because, you know, that wasn't much schism and stand open. Anyway, I came home from a late afternoon seminar and walked into their bedroom. I said, "How are you getting along? How do you feel? Let me look at your patients and see how broken out they are." It's rather tolerant of me. And I noticed that they were playing some kind of game, or so it seemed. They had a deck of playing cards, and I noticed that they had them all face down. Each had half the deck. And first, one would take the top card off of the deck and put it down face up. And other one would do the same thing, and then they would take turns picking up the two cards. And I watched this for a while, and I said, what are you doing? And they said, we're playing a game. And I said, well, does the game have a name? And they said, no, growing more and more irritated with a obtuse parent. And I said, well, what do you do? And they said, well, can't you see? And I said, yes, well, that leads me to the question. This is the way I talk to kids. That leads me to the question, what are the rules? And the older of the two looked up at me with this look of utter disgust and said, the only rule is you can't cheat. You can see the quality of the moral education that it's in here.
I want to reflect upon a question I said just before the break about what happens when one inhabits the world views. And related maybe to the question Bob Alcorn asked last night about what difference it makes in writing theology. I can see different ways of understanding what goes on there. One would be that when you make your point of view as a fully embodied person, mind, bodily, person, guiding theology, or whatever you do, you get in the mode you talked about, that sort of like your being takes over and you're not worried about one little category. And that, in fact, is a very enlightened kind of experience because you're in touch with the broader equal than at the other one, not just in the next. If that's the case, it seems to me that taking your little worldview does make a difference in how you live. Then things aren't just the same. Sinker suggested the break. And that maybe taking on this embodied worldview, well, even if here I come back to the step last night of the theological question, maybe something remotely like Paul's vision of the Holy Spirit, in the sense that you experience love, peace, and joy, and kind of strong image, so to say. And so that maybe you are, again, going back to different categories.
I'm quite comfortable with that. Right, to say it's possible to be comfortable with the categories love, truth, and joy. I think it's all that easy.
And if that is the case, then maybe all that you've been teaching makes a real difference.
It never bothered me whether it made a difference or not, because the reason I was doing it was that I felt that this is what I had been called to do. If in answering my calling all of these odd things happened and some of them I enjoyed seeing happen, that was a bonus.
It's a very Polanyian note.
Well, that's the ultimate compliment, Johnny.
It's also very Baptist.
Bill, as you know, I was intrigued with your line in your book of Imagine a Man Who Has No Sensitive and Melody Deaf and would like to use that in a paper on. But what did some of your work have to do with understanding what happens in humor? And another goal I have for this is that that perhaps someday someone may look at the daily comic strips and be reminded of some of these things you're trying to point out. And so I'd like to ask a question. Harry Prost talks about the notion that that the name of a building bears on the building, but the building does not bear back on the name, not the other way around. Or Polanyi talks about trying to find out the meaning of a word, and then when you try to find out the meaning of a word, you're looking at what does the word bear on, you can't do it the other way. And so my thinking for many years has been that that just trying to do it the other way, get the building to bear back on the word, is what humor is all about.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and the one question I have, however, is that when humor takes place, there is this explosion. I like the concept of the explosion. Mm-hmm. Perhaps even you could make a parallel with the explosion of Abraham into another world. And could you comment on anything that happens in this explosion that might be more than just a trivial realizing that there were two meanings to the word? It seems to me there's something that happens there when you're thrown into the mess, or when you're able to explode to the other world, happens during these moments of humor. There's an oscillation and a double take, and there's possibly a looking at the ground, and you get alienated and all kinds. And then there's a laughter and an explosion. So is there anything you can say about the structure of the way that happens, and similar to, let's say, what happens when a scientist makes a discovery? You know, the leaping out of the bathtub with Eureka, I have found it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not sure that I am prepared to comment at a great length on what seems to me to be a most interesting line of exploration, and I hope you'll do it and send me a copy. I've always just thought that comedy was a situation in which one had a contradiction of some sort, and I think that's what you're saying. And that in response to this contradiction, providing that the contradiction does not cause pain and does not admit of resolution, we call this comedy. However, the contradictions in life that are the cause of pain and are not susceptible of resolution are tragedy. Now, I have not thought at all about the import for a theory of comedy that is implicit in what I took you to be saying, namely Frosch's argument about the word bearing on the building, but the building not bearing on the word. For myself, it ain't so that in actual dwelling in the world, the building bears upon the word quite as much as the world does on the building, or can. That does not in any way, however, imply that your use of this strange kind of reversibility as a medium for comedy is not a sound one. And I guess I've really said a good deal more about that than I'm confident with that. Time is going short. I think we have one more question, and then we will give Bill a chance for a final word, and then I have a little benedictory. Yes.
Well, I wonder if at the end of your go back to the beginning, I was very disappointed by your first book, the important first book, Mind, Body, and Spirit. There's a dialogue in the multiple mind and body, isn't that great? Again, with this person, it would be used to move. I'm aware of the possibility that screen client personally, yeah, you know, being your own body and the power of your ribs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, there's nothing wrong with using the soul in that context.
Okay. So I just wanted to be not having much of a break in your story. So like 2 feet, coming back. You were here.
Well, the basic motif of our relationship was that of a young and on that account essentially physically vigorous junior taking care of somebody who was incompetent to do this for himself. And this was one of the reasons that Michael Carlining was irresistible to women. I remember being at a restaurant one night and talking to my companion about Carlining, and I was saying he was handsome, and he was charming, and he was witty, and he was absolutely helpless. And the waitress, the wait person, overheard this. And she said, "Oh my God." The import of her gesture being, how could you resist this combination? Now, I loved Michael Carlining first and foremost as a man whom it was a pleasure to make laugh. I don't mean to suggest by this that it came hard for him. We were visiting professors at the University of Texas for a semester and saw each other regularly. He was in a great state of anxiety because his arteriosclerosis had become crippling in a way. He was as lucid as he ever had been in abstract matters, but he could not remember names. He mixed up events of the First World War with the events of the Second World War. Mm-hmm. He could not remember the name of the book Personal Knowledge. And so he subjected me every afternoon at 4 o'clock at the 40 Acres Club on the University of Texas campus to an absolutely grueling experience, though this was not intentional. What I mean by that was he said, if you must come by, he was staying at the 40 Acres Club, you must come by and we will have a chat. And we would go to the bar and sit down and we would have this chat. And the chat consisted of Michael talking and then saying, who was that, or what did he say, asking me? And so the 2 hours that we were together left me absolutely exhausted because I was trying to figure out where it was he was going. I'm feeling very anecdotal at this point, and perhaps it's not inappropriate. He was the youngest member of his family, as we know, and he had never been on very good terms, particularly with his brothers. They were Marxists, and they had married women who were Marxists, and there was a great deal of estrangement among them. I remember when he was a visiting professor at Duke in 1954, I took him with me over to the University of North Carolina, Greensboro, where I was conducting an honors seminar, and we were reading Personal Knowledge, and I said, "Girls, this is Michael Carlining." And he immediately began to charm them in his usual way, and on the way home, it was an early spring night, a full moon, and it seemed as if this were the time to ask the question which I had refrained from asking because the right time had not yet presented itself. But I turned to him and I said, "Michael, was your father a practicing Jew?" And he said, "I don't know. I never asked him." I thought this was quite astonishing.
I report that because 20 years later, when we were in Austin together, he was trying to recover all of those things that he had lost in the various ways. There was a huge oil painting of the family. It would have covered all of that wall over there, with Mother Polanyi, who was a strikingly beautiful woman, and a salonnière into whose salon the intellectual and political elite of Budapest of that time regularly repaired for philosophical discussion. And Michael, in this painting, is sitting in front as if he were the mascot of the faculty, with this beatific expression on his face. And I had never seen this, but he pulled out of his briefcase a color photograph of it. And he said, "This is my family, and I'm trying to recover them." And then he went through the painting, pointing out who each one of these people were and what had happened to them. And he said, "I'm trying to write a memoir in behalf of my sister-in-law, from whom I was estranged for 30 years. She was the wife of Carl Polanyi and a vigorous Marxist who disliked Michael extremely because Carl and he got along better than any of the other two brothers." Bill Scott can correct my impressions here because he knows the facts. But he was trying to write a memoir to be about his brother Carl, to be presented to the Hungarian Academy, memorializing the great economic historian Carl Polanyi. And he said, "This chore that I'm doing, this task that I'm doing, is the mark of the healing that has at last been achieved among those of us that are still alive." Several of them and their wives or husbands were taken off and killed in concentration camps. So here, barely able to remember the events of the day before yesterday, although vividly remembering those of 40 and 50 years earlier, even though he mixed them up, was Michael Polanyi trying to return to his mind-bodily roots in the world. Now, what else would you like me to say on this subject?
How young were you when you read it?
How young was I? I was an assistant professor already at the University of North Carolina. This was 1952. In Manchester, we had corresponded because I had read some of his early articles. And I sensed that he had something of mutual interest to talk about. So I wrote him a letter and said, "I'm going to be in Manchester. I'm going to be in England a couple of conferences. Could I come by Manchester and see you?" And he wrote me back enthusiastic and said, "In such and such a length of meeting restaurant, and we'll have a lager here, and you will have a chat." Well, it was, of course, a delight for both of us because nobody had ever paid him any attention as a philosopher. And I was taken far too seriously by him because he had found somebody interested in what he was doing, and therefore I was taken far too seriously by Margaret, his wife, who had a party at their flat to which the intellectuals of the British Empire were assembled. I mean the Chief Justice of the British Supreme Court, the headmaster of Manchester Grammar School, which is even a more important post, the editor of the Manchester Guardian, and many, many other people who took me to be a very important person because Polanyi thought I was important, which I was certainly not. And it was quite an odd experience to be approached by people and ask, what's going on philosophically in America?
Well, that may be a good place to stop. Are there any final words you want to say about these two sessions together, Bill?
I've had a hell of a good time. That's my final word.
That's your mind-body state of existence.
Yeah.
So I'll read two passages just to wind things up. In our culture, the time for relocating the axis of our existence is very late. Perhaps it has already passed. It is still possible, nonetheless, for us to remain steadfast at our posts. And then, under this regime, being, at once steadfast and intentional, is seen to be the provenance of reality and truth, coherence and value, closer to each of us than we are to ourselves. Thank you very much, Bill. It's been exciting and interesting.
Very fine.